This is Alan Chartok. With us today is Harriet Kendi, creator of Artful Mind magazine and a freelance artist currently teaching art in the Renaissance Art School in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Welcome, Harriet.
Hi, how are you?
Well, you spell your name funny. Instead of the regular Harriet way, you're H-A-R-R-Y-E-T. What was that about?
Oh, well, I was named after my grandfather, Harry.
Well, Harriets can be named after their grandfathers, Harry, too, can they?
Yeah, I guess they thought it was different and odd, and I guess they wanted a boy, and it came out a female, so they did the best they could.
Well, were your folks, when they named you, did that indicate to us that they were sort of wild and different?
Well, they were wild and different because they were wild enough to adopt me.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that. You were adopted. How come? What happened?
Oh, because my real mom was struggling to, you know, get her life together, and her big sister said, no more. I already had a big brother. So she goes, out. We all want this kid. We can't have this kid, so you have no choice. Give her up for adoption. So reluctantly, Judy said, all right.
Well, we now know that you've gotten back together with her, but that comes later. Let's talk now about your adoptive parents. Who were they, and why did they want you?
Well, they were in their 50s, and they couldn't have kids, and they really wanted one. And they went through the Jewish adoptive services, and when I came along, they said, we want a kid. We want to give this kid what we can give, aside from love, education, and we want our family to grow a little bit.
And were you the only kid?
Yeah, I was the only child.
And where did you live?
Pelham Parkway in the Bronx.
Well, see, we know that together because we both are products of a college education, at least I am, at the Bronx House camps in Copaic, New York. I went to Hunter in the Bronx, which was like, you know, you get on the train and you go home. So you didn't get the, quote, socialization experience that you got at Bronx House. So tell me about life in the Bronx. What was that like?
Life in the Bronx was a lot of brick. Our backyard had a little square of grass and one tree with pink flowers in it, and very, very ethnic, Jewish ethnic culture, the Jewish bakery, the Jewish Lomans for girdles, the Jewish hair salon, Jewish, Italian. And it was very, very grouped together as a nice community near Jacoby Hospital, the Einstein Hospital. So it was a nice neighborhood. We lived across the street from horse riding stables, of all things. Orchard Beach was nearby. City Island was nearby. Mm-hmm. And I'm always in a bus or a train. We did not have a car.
What did your folks do?
My father owned a bunch of grocery stores on the Grand Concourse. Mm. And he retired really young and sat in the chair of the New York Times the rest of the time.
Really?
Yeah.
Why did he do that?
He just had enough. I guess, you know, he came from Russia at the age of 13, smoked his camels, did his business, got enough money going, did the stocks, you know, sat in the stock house on the Grand Concourse with his cronies, and had just said, I'm retiring. I did it.
I already did it, and I have enough.
He thought he had enough, yeah.
Yeah. And your mom?
She was a housewife and mother.
What do you make of that?
She had a hard job.
She did?
She had a tough job.
Why was it so tough?
Because there's always things to clean up, always things to oversee in the house and running around after me nonstop.
But it's something you wouldn't have wanted to do when you came into your maturity, was it? To be a housewife?
I hear her voice in my head saying, you'll get yours. You'll see what it's like on the other side of the table. And I was like, yeah, okay. And yeah, I see what she's saying. It's a lot of work and we all want it because it's kind of like normal. But every day is a wonderful, new, exciting challenge.
Harriet Kendi, you went to elementary school and junior high school in the Bronx.
Oh, yeah.
Were you artistic in those days?
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah.
So you applied to the High School of Music and Art.
Oh, you bet.
What was that like?
Well, it was exciting because you have to walk up 103-odd steps when you get off of the train at 125th Street. And then you see this
135th, right?
135th Street, yeah. And there's these huge escalation of steps that go up to this castle-like thing that used to be a nunnery in the, I don't know what year.
The castle.
Know. Yeah, when Harlem was Dutch. Yeah. So the interview and the test that you had to take.
What was that like? What did they make you do?
They made me draw a set of rolls on a plate.
Really?
Yeah, a still life. I did the best I can. No, it flew right out of my system. It was.
Were you the best artist at music and art?
No, but I was always an A student in art and a D student in math.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Because I think it's tough to go to that school and be the worst as opposed to the best or near the best.
If you're the worst, you're out.
No. I know somebody very well, somebody very close to me who went and who may have been, you know, the worst clarinet player at music and art. But, you know, it's tough to be surrounded by people who really are better at music and art or art than you are.
There's not so much competitiveness as camaraderie in my days when I was in that school.
Mm-hmm.
Camaraderie was more important than competition, and we were all learning together at the same time.
Mm-hmm. They moved music and art down to Lincoln Square.
They
changed the name. How'd you feel about that?
Ugh, abandonment.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. Was not a pretty day.
What'd you do about college?
Oh, college? Well, because my SAT scores were nil and void. I went through the back door. I applied to a private school, the School of Visual Arts.
Where's
that? On 23rd in Lexington. And I got in, and it was a pure commercial and fine art school.
Mm-hmm. Was it a college or was it a sort of an institute?
It was a private university.
Really?
It goes through the regular accreditabilities, and it's normal. You know, it's just not like Pratt. It's a private school that is...
Well, Pratt's independent. It's not private. Pratt is an independent school, but it's not a city university or anything like that.
No, this wasn't either. David Rhodes is the president of the school, and he interviewed me to get into the school.
So I wanted to ask you, what was that like, this institute?
This was the opposite of music and art.
Yeah.
This was total competition. I mean, you pound the pavement and you get cutthroat right off the bat. So you're wondering if you're going to be making friends right off the bat because everyone's like bucking horns. But I found that I overlooked the competitiveness. I said, I'm going to do the best I can, relate to my teachers and understand them and kind of get this experience under my belt.
Yeah. So what did you do? I mean, what kind of work did you do?
I did sculpture, I did art history, I even worked in art therapy at Bellevue Hospital as an assistant to the art therapy department teacher. We would go in once a week and work with patients in Bellevue, which was not too far away.
Well, Bellevue is very famous in New York. It's where when they pick somebody up and they're outrageous, they send them. So do you have any memorable experiences from your time at Bellevue?
Yes, I do. I remember having to fight with the scissors with someone.
Really?
Yeah, one of the patients really wanted to cut this thing out, and they were, I had to, like, show him how because he was, like, out of control with them. So I remember having to pull the scissor. One end of the scissor was with me, and the other end was with him. And then we were doing this tug-of-war thing, and then finally he just, like, stopped, and I got the scissors back.
Yeah, because you couldn't let him have the scissors, right?
I mean, well, not with my supervision and complete guidance, but he started taking control. So it was an awkward situation of like, is he going to hurt himself or is he going to end up cutting this piece of paper like he's supposed to? It was an unknown, surprising situation, and I thought that in my understanding and learning experience in art therapy that you don't give someone scissors unless you're there watching them, and I kind of did, but it turned out okay. I got the scissors back, and he recut, and that was it.
Could have turned out differently, though.
Yeah, it depends
on... And then, boy, you would have been in trouble. So, Harriet Kendi, let's go and... Did you graduate?
I transferred.
Really? Where'd you transfer to?
To New York University.
Really?
The competition was just too... much.
You mean at the visual arts?
Yeah, it was too much.
Yeah, interesting. So you went to NYU and you majored in art?
I majored in art education and art history.
And how long did it take you to get out of there? Or did you?
I did. It was 4 years later.
Really? So all together in visual arts and NYU spent how long?
Six.
6 years, that's a long time.
Yeah, but I also started taking master courses towards the end of NYU years.
From master artists?
Master classes, so for my degree, if I went for my master's, they would apply.
Oh, master, I see what you mean, yeah. Okay, that's great. Did you go for your master's?
I started to, and then I didn't continue because it just didn't fit into my life at the time. And
what was your life like?
Well, let's see, at that point, gosh, so much to recall. So I graduated from NYU finally, and
what year, do you remember?
No, okay. I don't remember. Right. Okay. It's one of those 19-somethings, but yeah, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was supposed to stick around the city, get a job, and get married. I was already engaged to a very nice guy, but I left. I became the art director in a summer camp, Crane Lake Camp in West Stockbridge.
Right near us. Yeah, right in the Berkshires.
And I loved it there.
Did you?
I had a great summer.
What was that camp like?
Well, I became friends with Lisa Ulanoff, who was the director's niece. She had an apartment in West Stockbridge. So on our days off, what better thing to do is to hang out in her apartment and, you know, just get to know the Berkshires more, because I love the Berkshires already. The camp was really...
You love the Berkshires from the Bronx House days?
I love the Berkshires from the Bronx House days. I remember taking people to Tanglewood on the days off, except for the fact that Tanglewood has a special schedule.
Yeah.
And our days off, it didn't matter. I just wanted to go up to Tanglewood, and we come to Tanglewood and we find out, oh my God, there's no concert tonight. But, you know, I was okay because we were
on the grounds.
There. Yeah.
So let's go back to Bronx House. You were going to Bronx House camps during your high school years and college years?
Oh, no. Bronx House actually came a lot earlier. It was when I was in, like, I think, seventh and eighth grade.
So you were a camper there.
I was a camper there. Mm-hmm. But I stopped going there, and I went to another camp, Natchez.
Yes, across the lake.
Yes, and Circle Camp down in the other direction towards New York and Sullivan County.
Yeah. How many of these were Jewish camps?
They were all Jewish camps.
And how important was Jewish identity to you and to your parents?
Well, to my parents, it was most important. To me, it was less, because I knew that the campers and the counselors were not all Jewish. They were all from all over.
Mm-hmm.
So the roots were Jewish, and that was kind of nice.
Yeah.
I felt comfortable with that.
Let's go back to the boyfriend who you almost married, who you were engaged to. How did that happen? What happened there?
He was Israeli, and I met him through a friend, and he was very debonair and charming.
Yeah.
He lived in the Bronx and had a nice car, and he took me to all these beautiful restaurants, and he was like my key to freedom. He had an apartment. I mean, it was like those years when, you know, my age,
yeah,
I was probably like 20, when your boyfriend actually is your key to your freedom. And he was, you know, that to me.
I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, we would travel.
And it was permissible because the wraps were coming off everything.
Yes.
Did you get into the city at all? You know, when you lived in the Bronx or Queens, one went into the city, which was Manhattan.
Yeah, the 6 train. But then when Amir came into the picture, it was like driving in. So it was much better.
Yeah.
Taking the 6 train, because the 6 train and the 12 bus was my normal form of transportation, which is one major reason why I wanted to get out of the city, was because I was so fed up with public transportation. It sounds dumb, but it's not.
But during this time, were you aware of the fact that you were adopted and that, you know, there was this other side, you know, waiting to be found out?
Yes, I knew I was adopted when I was really little. They kept plugging it at me.
What did they say?
You know, you're very special, you were adopted.
Oh, I see, right.
You know, you're very special, you were adopted. Okay, yeah, that's good. But I never wanted to open up Pandora's box. I didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
I had a great life. I didn't want to know nothing. I didn't want to have to look at someone that looked like me, you know, because I wanted to feel like I was unique.
Yeah.
That I'm not like anybody else. And
if you had family, then you would know that you would have people who looked like you.
Yeah, and then I'd feel like one of the eggs in the carton, you know.
One of the eggs in the carton.
But this way I felt special. The only thing about being adopted was that there's a sense of loneliness you feel, because you don't have a sense of serious roots, and you do not have brothers and sisters to fight with, argue with, and talk to, and there was a bit of loneliness. I remember that.
Well, you might have had that as a single child in any case, right? Whether you were adopted or not.
Probably, yeah. Except maybe there's still more of a connection, because the parents and the child have a connection, an internal connection that I didn't have really with my adopted parents, because I always felt the sense that they were different, or not that they were different, but I was different. I looked different. I acted different. I was rebellious.
From them.
Yes.
Well, a lot of kids were like that in those days, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, as you were coming up, yeah.
I might have been a little bit more, though. I was a troubly kind of kid.
Were you?
I was very rebellious.
What were the manifestations of that? How would we know you were rebellious?
Because I was actually...
And we should point out, by the way, as we do this interview, that your daughter is sitting right next to you.
Oh, hello.
So therefore, you know, I'm going to ask you, how were you rebellious?
I didn't listen to a word my parents told me.
Did you smoke dope?
Yeah. I didn't like it. I didn't like the cloudiness. It was a bothersome feeling.
Sex?
Young. Everybody grew up...
Fast.
Fast.
In them days. Okay, let's go back to Amir. The Israeli. How'd you ditch him? Or did he ditch you?
We ditched each other. Because when I left Crane Lake Camp, I didn't go back to the Bronx. I moved in with Lisa Ulanoff in West Stockbridge. And Amir was like, are you coming back? And I was like, I don't think so.
But you were engaged.
Yeah, and it dragged on for a while till
finally. Did you have a ring and all?
Yeah.
Wow.
But finally, I told him that this is my place and this is a really great place. Please move up because I'm going to start moving on.
Move up to West Stockbridge.
Yeah.
Now, West Stockbridge.
Move your window business from Queens to West Stockbridge. It's a great idea.
What was his? What window business?
Well, he had Window World, and he was racking in the dollars. He was putting windows in all the houses in Queens, and he was doing really well. Really well. I mean, you know.
Window World. I like
it. Yeah. He still does Window World. No, it's only in Florida.
Are you in touch with him?
No, but I do know that he's still doing Window World.
Yeah. You check in on him.
Every once in a blue moon to see what the old people are doing, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So Window World. That's great. That's a great story. It's a long story we used to tell each other as kids about the guy who kept getting the messages that the Viper was coming. The Viper was coming. He's very scared. One day the guy knocks on the door and says, I'm here. He says, who are you? He said, the Window Viper. The Viper's coming. So, okay, Window World. So then there was a breakup, a formal breakup. Do you remember the night it happened or the day it happened?
Yeah, it was... the day that I was with my new boyfriend, Rob Gordon.
Wait, so you had a new boyfriend while you were engaged.
Yeah, okay. And there was a kind of like a car chase, and finally...
What do you mean, kind of like a car chase?
Well, we were in... there was a kind of like a car chase when I got into one car, and Amir was in his car chasing us and trying to catch up. Finally, Amir just... ended up on the Taconic Parkway heading back to Queens, and it was over.
Did you give him back the ring?
The ring actually got lost down the shower drain.
Before or after the breakup?
Before.
Okay. And have you ever gone back to that shower drain and said, well, maybe we ought to take this apart and see whether it's you?
No. My parents sold the house.
No, okay. So now you're done with that. You have a boyfriend. How long did he last?
Rob was my mentor in the Berkshires. He opened up many, many, many doors and experiences for me, meeting people and making connections. And we were going out for about 2.5 years.
What did he do?
He was a lot older than me, too. And
How old? How much older?
He was, I think he was like almost 14 years older than me.
Yeah. And at a young age, that's a lot.
Yeah, but it was okay for me because those were my learning years. It's continuing my learning years.
I'm not being critical.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to get the picture. Okay. So now, 2.5 years, you meet all the people in the Berkshires, you become ensconced in the Berkshires, you become part of us, you know, what we like, what we love in the Berkshires. Now, let's go back to your other family, you know, the adoptive folks who gave you up. This was still percolating with you, right? At what point did you decide, you know, I'd really like to know who they are?
I never did. I never wanted to know who my real parents were. But one day, my mother called me up. And she said, sit down. I have to tell you something. And I sat down.
Was your father still alive during that time?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
She goes, your birth parents are making the efforts to look for you. They came to the house asking where you were. And the next door neighbors told them where you were by mistake. They didn't know that, you know, we were trying to avoid this from happening. So you're going to get a letter in the mail from your real mother. And I was okay with that. I was like, whatever, you know. It's like, well, you're my mom. I don't really care about any interference. It's not going to change anything. The next day I was locking the windows and doors. I got kind of spooked.
Yeah.
It was an unexpected feeling of feeling that someone was going to just barge into my life and turn things upside down, and I don't think I really wanted it. For some reason, I thought a witch was coming after me, you know. But that didn't happen. She was actually very nice.
Whoa, hey, whoa, whoa, whoa. How did it happen? what was the moment?
So her letter came to me, and I looked at her handwriting. I read the letter, looked at her handwriting, and I...
And where were you at that point? You were still at Music and Art, or was it before?
No, we're going now to the present almost 23 years ago. This is 23.
So were you in the Berkshires yet?
Yeah.
Okay, you were in the Berkshires. Your mother gets in touch with you. She says, here's what's happened. Okay. So you start locking the doors where? Now you're not in the Bronx anymore. You start locking the doors in West Stockbridge.
Yeah, it was an
instinct. And they told you were in West Stockbridge, the neighbors,
no,
right?
No, this is when we actually moved to Lake Buell. I was already married at this time.
Okay.
So we're talking like 23 years ago. She's 23, my daughter's 23. So this is like all within the last 23 years.
Okay, so you have to give us a little perspective. I know you don't want to give us your age, but give us a range.
I'm old enough to vote.
Okay. So 23 years ago, this happens. You start locking your doors in the Berkshires.
It was just like a reaction. Like, I know we don't lock our doors, but I don't want to have someone driving into the driveway and peeking in on me without me knowing it. And I had no idea what she looked like. It was almost like a clone of me, only older. It felt kind of weird having that take place. So through the connection of the letter and a phone call, something settled inside of me and said, you know what, this is okay.
They called you?
Yes, Judy called me.
Do you remember how that happened? What happened when Judy called you? Do you remember what happened? Do you picked up the phone and there was your birth mother?
You pick up the phone and hello, and it was hello, and it was like, okay, I keep going, you know, hi, how are you? Good, how are you? You know who this is? This is your birth mother, Judy, and I just wanted to introduce myself to you. And I was like, okay, you know, how are you with, you know, that kind of thing. It's light and easy and touching on delicate new areas.
Like what?
Slowly and cautiously. And
what were some of the new areas that were?
One of my first questions to her was, what's our health like? You know, it's like, what's in my blood?
Oh, interesting. Do we have Tay-Sachs disease in the family?
Yeah, diabetes, yeah. You know, the big C, whatever.
Yeah. And?
We're good. We're good to go. It's like, that's good. I'm glad. We have no problems. No, a couple of diabetes cases, but that's avoidable today. We can, you know, we can manage with that. New medicine takes care of that.
Diet.
And diet, right?
Yeah. Okay. Did anybody cry during that conversation?
Hell no.
No, okay. So, hell no. So now this occurred, and what came of it?
What came of it was, honestly, for me, a distance. Nice to know you. It's interesting to see what you look like. Your lifestyle is interesting.
Did she try to tell you why she gave you up at the
time? Yeah.
In that first conversation?
Yeah, and pictures and photographs. She took out everything, all the goods and hardware.
Wait. You're skipping a step. You actually got to meet her.
Yeah, when she came up.
Oh, she came up. Well, you forgot to tell me about that.
Yeah, okay. Well, okay. You know, I see it in my mind.
Okay,
but
so she came up.
And she was very nice. I mean, her and her husband, not my father, but her husband, both came up and...
Did you ever meet your father?
No, he's the mystery link.
Interesting.
He's where I get my artistic skills.
Did she tell you anything about that? About him?
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot. There's a lot.
For example?
Well, he mysteriously abandoned Judy and took off and just left everything high and dry.
Did she blame him for the giving up of the baby, you?
No, I think she blamed her sister.
Oh, because the sister said...
Said, look, you're alone now and you already got Ronald.
Yeah.
You don't want to handle another child. You can't. So she was convinced.
Did she tell you why she didn't abort?
They didn't believe in that. I mean, she did not believe in that kind of thing.
Was she Jewish?
Yeah.
All right, so now there's this meeting. This is fascinating. Come on, don't spare us on any of the details here. So there's this meeting. She takes out all the photographs. She does all that. In the initial phone call, you said you reported that there was a sort of distance between you and her. Did that distance begin to dissipate as you met with her?
Has ins and outs. has closeness and distance. Almost like we're very independent of each other.
No, not now. Then.
Then it was like she wanted to move in on me and get to know me and, you know, be the grandma right off the bat, you know, charge down into my life and get into everything, and was very aggressive about it. And I was okay because I'm a laid back kind of person. I was like, you know, let's see who she, what she is, what she's all about. Let me see if I can get to know her while she's coming towards me. While she wants to get to know me, I might as well, you know, give her the chance and get to know her and see what's,
what you
she's
know?
All about.
What'd you want to know, Harriet?
What I wanted to know, which was interesting, was why it took her so long to find me.
And what'd she say?
She said that she had hired detectives and she finally got in touch with the senator, a senator, to track me down. She said for all these years she was looking for me. And at that point, I told her, you know, I really didn't care about ever knowing who you were. I'm not that kind of person. I could have been fine without you. But you know what? I like you. You're okay. We have our differences, though.
What are your differences?
She's very, very, very busy, 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 busy doing these continuous projects, you know, knitting projects and crafts projects and things that just bother me, that I, you know, like I don't like being flaky, but I have to say, oh, that's wonderful, when I'm really like, well, that's wonderful for you, but I can't join you in this process of liking the things you like. I'm in a different place.
Well, was that a little snotty on your part that you're a good artist and she wasn't?
Kind of, yeah, but I really had a great background. I mean, my adopted parents gave me a lot.
Well, speaking of which, what was the tension between your birth mom and your regular mom as a result of this?
As a result, my mother, my adopted mother, was 97 when she died. And for the time period, which was those 23 some odd years that she told me about Judy, after that, I didn't want to hurt her feelings. So we kind of kept it a secret. I kept it separate.
Secret or separate?
I would say separate, because if she asked me about Judy, I would tell her.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
But I just kept the departments in their own little corners.
And how long during this process of these years till she got to be 95 was your dad gone?
That was 8 years before she left.
Before she died?
Yes.
Okay.
But the difference between the two sets, or Judy and Rose and Herman...
Rose and Herman were your adoptive parents.
Yeah, that was like night and day. Like, Judy was 65 and doing country square dancing, wearing mini skirts and going to rock concerts. And Rose and Herman were the traditional Jewish people that would go to temple and eat kosher and came home and changed into their inside house clothes and settle down for the night, watching TV and, you know, going Sundays, maybe out downtown, very conservative and style and totally opposite of Judy. Judy was like ready to rock and roll off the planet.
And when Rose and Herman went downtown, I take it to the city, to New York, where did they go?
Lincoln Center.
Oh, interesting. Because my folks took me to Orchard Street. To buy things down there on the Lower East.
Nice
Lower
place.
Lower East Side, right. Okay, so now this is getting us somewhere now. So now we have to go back to how you got married. Who'd you marry?
Bob.
Tell us about Bob.
Mr. Bob, we met when we were dancing one night in a place called Brannigan's, which is like on Route 7 towards Pittsfield.
Right, I know it.
And after that night we met, we liked each other.
Whoa, come on. What was it like?
In detail, it was very noisy, so we couldn't really talk too much, but I liked his face, and he kind of liked me, whatever.
And you had been separate from the last guy.
The last one was gone.
Long gone. Okay.
Yeah.
So now, this guy, and this is a long time ago?
About 23 years ago.
Okay, so we're talking 1990-ish, something like that?
Yeah, because that's when Shoshana was born, 1990. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So you danced. You were going to tell
danced.
Us.
We had a good
and
time.
And how was that, the dancing?
I liked him. The thing is that I drew pictures of him when I was little. I did this visualization thing I wasn't aware of. I would draw pictures of my kids and Robert.
This is way before you had anybody.
This is when I was really young, yeah. Like from when I was 10 and up. I would always be drawing these faces, and they visualized, they materialized, they came to life. There was Robert. I drew him a million times.
So you're telling us that you sort of drew, in a crystal ball sort of way, the people that would come into your life much later.
Yes.
Now, there'll be people who are listening to this, who think you're nuts.
Of course.
Are they, or is this really so?
To make me sound more nuts.
What if I sat you down with a piece of paper right now? Could you draw something that's going to happen to you 10 years from now?
No, because I was totally unconscious of it being in that kind of stream or direction. I had no conscious intention of that to happen. I was drawing, and when I would draw, what would I draw? I would draw faces. The same kind of faces, the same kind of people. To make it seem even more weird is that, you know, even if those pieces of art ended up in a portfolio of mine or somewhere rolled up,
you still had them.
They're gone. They disappeared. I don't have anything.
Okay, all right. So you couldn't show Bob that you had actually drawn him back in the day.
No, but if he trusts me what I say, then that's good enough.
No, that's fine. Okay. So now Brannigan's dancing. One thing leads to another.
Frisbee at Tanglewood.
What did he do? What did he do for a living?
Well, he was actually an outdoorsman, working with his dad, working with lumber, working out in the fields, leveling off land.
Okay, but if people are listening now and they don't know who you are, we're talking to Harriet Candy, and she spells her first name H-A-R-R-Y-E-T, Harriet, because that's what Rose and Herman named you, right?
Yeah.
My father's name was Herman, too. Okay, yes. Okay.
Wow.
And I used to say, what's your middle name? He'd say, I have no middle name. I'd say, come on now, everybody has a middle name. He'd say, okay, do you have an initial? He'd say, yes. He'd say, what's that? H, he'd say. I'd say, so is it Herman Shartog? He'd say, yes. Okay, so now Bob is an outdoorsman. You're in love with an outdoorsman. You get together. When did you decide to get married?
Oh, about 6 months after we met.
Really? Okay. And you marry Bob. And how does he support you, or how do you support him?
Oh, well, I was always freelancing and starting The Artful Mind at that time, and Bob was working for his dad.
Stop. The Artful Mind is a magazine which you've been running for how long?
20th year anniversary is at this moment.
20 years. To keep a magazine going in the Berkshires for 20 years, what was your vision of what The Artful Mind would be?
All I did was I thought of the name one day, The Artful Mind, because of Oliver and The Artful Dodger, and stuck in my mind. I want to do a magazine called The Artful Mind in the Berkshires, because at that point I was tired of doing logos and brochures and, you know.
That's what you were doing as a freelancer,
freelancing,
right?
Yes.
How'd you get those gigs?
Pounding the pavement or pounding the grass.
Were
or
they all in the Berkshires? Or did some of them happen in New York City? I mean, how did you do it? Was there word of mouth about
at
your time?
At times, I would go back to the city and work for the Penny Saver and get my mechanicals done in Westchester and bring them back up.
What's a mechanical?
Mechanical is is what we used to do for getting an ad together, what it would take to get the ad together, meaning the fonts, the typesetting need to be done, the camera work, all the stuff that doesn't exist anymore. It's much easier
now. Because
it's
all computer now, right?
It's all computer now.
Do you remember what your greatest freelance job was that exists to this day?
Oh, God, yeah.
What is it?
My first job was actually designing and redesigning the logo on the gas tank for a Hell's Angel.
No.
Yeah.
How'd you get the gig?
I advertised in the Penny Saver, and he called me up.
In the Berkshires?
Yeah.
Okay.
And he said, I have a job for you.
Really?
I said, okay. So we met, and I was open-minded to it. I had no problem with anything.
Sure. Were you a little scared of him? Did you think?
No, I was fascinated.
Yeah.
I thought he was fascinating. I'm fascinated by people to begin with.
Yeah.
And so I listened to what he wanted. He wanted the exact logo on his gas tank of his motorcycle. Can you do it? I said, yeah, I could do it. I could do it.
Go ahead.
And so he said, okay, I'll bring over the car paints and the logo and we'll do it. I said, okay, I'll do it. And we talked about price. I made $75 when it was all done. So he came over to the house, 7 o'clock in the evening, and he set out all the paints that actually matched. And the funny thing was is that I had Rob Gordon, my boyfriend at the time, coming over too.
Oh yeah, 14 year older Rob Gordon.
Yes.
Was he bigger than the Hell's Angel?
He's tall and skinnier, yeah.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
He's cute. Right. He would be watching me and the Hell's Angel guy, and the Hell's Angel guy was there watching me to make sure for some reason that I didn't alter the logo.
Right, right.
Or take the logo and for some reason put it in my pocket. I'm not sure what that was about. Okay. That was his thing. So we were all doing this. We're all doing this on the living room floor, and there's the gas tank and there's the paint. What went through my mind is like, you know, what do I do if I mess up? It's like, what if I do if the wrong line? But you know what? I screamed all that out and I focused and I did it and I did
just a great
job.
Just like in music and art. Just like when they took you in and they said, draw the bread. This is draw the thing.
Draw the skull. I did it.
You draw the skull. And what was it, a skull and...
Skull and crossbones, I think. I don't remember
okay.
at this point.
So you get it done, and the boyfriend was watching the Hell's Angels.
Yeah.
Did you ever have the feeling he was coming on?
No, never.
No, never.
In fact, I think it was kind of maybe the opposite. I remember I went to their clubhouse. He invited me to the clubhouse, and there was pictures all with Hell's Angels on one side of the wall and Hell's Angels on the other side of the wall. And I looked at him, looked at the pictures, and he said, these are the ones that are dead on one side of the wall, and these are the ones that are still living. And then I'm looking at him, and I'm looking at his face, and I said, how come you don't have a beard like all the others do? And he goes, because I can't grow hair. And I was like, okay, maybe I got to go now. Maybe I better say goodbye, because I think I might have struck a sensitive chord with him with my questions, but it was okay. I passed the interview, and we got it done.
I'm astounded that none of the others hired you to do their work also.
I don't know.
Never happened. Okay, so now let's talk about The Artful Mind a little bit more, the magazine that you run. Let's talk Talkless now. You and I both know that magazines in the Berkshires come and go. Speaking of Michelangelo, they come, they go, they disappear. You've kept this thing alive all the time. How come?
It's my love.
Does your husband, Bob, put anything into this enterprise?
Yeah, when are you going to get a real job?
So he does. Can we just ask a question? Is he rich now?
Oh, he's totally rich.
Yeah, so he's helped out, right? So now you put this magazine out, and the artists flock to you because they want their names in your magazine. And how do you keep it alive?
Well, how do you keep WAMC alive?
Well, I don't. Everybody else does. People like you do.
That's exactly what I would say.
Yeah? How so? People want to support it because it's the right thing to do.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, it's not a not-for-profit like this is, right?
No.
It doesn't make any profit, but it's not a not-for-profit.
It's a charity organization.
Right.
But pays the bills.
So how important is a magazine like The Artful Mind? And the Berkshires are chock full of artists. What does the existence of the magazine mean to the artists?
Connection, exposure, building a rapport, a following, and getting your name out, getting your work out, getting buyers, and becoming...
Do people get buyers because their stuff is in the magazine?
Yes, they have.
Yeah.
They have.
Okay,
yes.
Now I notice when I read the magazine, and I want to talk to you about this from a journalistic point of view, that there are these descriptions of many of the art businesses and businesses in the Berkshires, including a music business and some of the others. The question I have for you is, do they pay for those?
Those go with your ad.
Okay, so if you take an ad, right, then you also get written up in the magazine.
They write it. It's their press release.
Uh-huh.
Or their blurb. It's their space. They can do whatever they want within reason. They can talk in their... hours or whatever place that they have.
Right.
You know.
But in addition to that, is there independent sort of journalism about the art world?
Yeah. I can say, Alan, I think you're really a fascinating guy. And I would say, would you like to be featured? Would you like to be interviewed?
But I can't draw.
That's okay. It's the arts.
I can't do anything.
It's not just visual art.
Yeah. I'm the kid in the class who covered everything in black after I tried something and said, this isn't working.
The equivalent of a non-singer.
Yeah, but you know, there you got talent. I mean, it doesn't have to be visual. It could be literary. It could be journalistic. It could be your talent, whatever you have. I like to bring out.
How often does the magazine come out?
I bring it out once a month.
That's a lot. Now, where do you have it printed?
I drive all the way up to New Bedford, Massachusetts.
It's a long way off. Why do you go there? Best price?
It's all expensive, but I love these guys.
Yeah.
I happen to have found a printing company that I can relate to. I love them.
Well,
Kevin
what makes you love them?
We work together on a personal level, eye to eye, and we're both honest and sincere about what's coming down the next month. And we talk on a really sincere level about what we need to have done and their points of view of what's going to happen with that printing month issue, how they're going to do it, and what my needs are according to how many pages it's going to be, what color is going to be on what pages, and we hash it out and say that's it.
So that's a six-hour drive to pick up your magazine.
Right.
And you could have the same sort of deal locally, but you don't do that. Do people give you a hard time about that?
Well, I mean, like, if you really want to know, I went to the printing company, and I had to say, okay, I swallowed it, my pride and ego, and I took the paper out knowing that every color image had a yellow shadow behind
it.
No,
we get that on the Legislative Gazette every once in a while. Yeah, the newspaper I publish.
I
understand that.
I deal with people that are fanatics about their printing. If one thing is askew, I hear it. I'm the one that takes the blame, even if I'm not the printers, because it's my magazine.
Sure.
So it's got to be perfect. And I found these printers who really understand that. They've got to look at everything. They got to stop the presses more often to do their quality check. They give me the best quality paper. They give me their time. They're just wonderful. I love how they do their job.
Does Bob ever come with you to pick up the magazine?
In bad weather.
So tell us about your family. How many kids do you have?
Let me think. I have two girls.
Yeah. And how's that been?
It's been wonderful.
You think you'd rather have girls than boys?
Doesn't matter. If they were boys, they would have been just as good.
Wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do your girls remind you at all of you when you were younger? You were rebellious. You talked about being rebellious. I've often wondered about this. Are mothers who were that way less charitable about their own kids?
You want to say don't do that because that's really stupid, I did that, but you can't do that.
You can't.
We have to kind of have real finesse and a talent and a real cool way of expressing yourself over and over again. Eventually, they do it. And eventually they say, you should have told me not to do it. So I say, you told me not to tell you so. There you go. Now you know what to do with it.
Well, I love the Berkshires. Roselle and I have lived there since 1971. And there's something so special about it, but I can never quite explain what that something special is. Can you?
Yes. It's.
You have this great voice. You say, yeah. I like that. Go ahead.
I think that the dynamics of it are so alive. There's like a constant activity, constant rejuvenation of things, constantly things being born, and people are brainstorming on the street. They're friendly to each other. People like to pick each other's brains in the grocery store all the time.
You started in West Stockbridge, which is one of my favorite towns in the whole world. I love it. Does West Stockbridge still play a role in your life?
Does it? Let's see. Not directly, except I did go into Six Depot, the new cafe there.
It's a wonderful place. And
I made really great connections with them. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, Six Depot it's called, and they have...
Six Depot.
Yeah, and I wrote a column about them not that long ago. Great people.
Yes.
So the Berkshires have that je ne sais quoi, but you mean to say that Saratoga doesn't have that, or New Paltz doesn't have that? They're wacky places also.
They are. They are. I'm sure there's things that I don't see that I don't know about.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure there are.
I just
have to say, though, that the art community that we have is just so incredibly strong.
But what about a bad artist? What about a bad artist who comes to see you and said, Harriet Candy, take a look at my art. I remember a woman who did ceramics, and if you looked in the middle of the cup, there was a sort of a figure. What if it's terrible? Do you have the ability to tell them it stinks?
There is no terrible art.
Oh, yes, there is. Oh, yes, there is. There is art that will make you want to throw up.
Well, that's your personal opinion.
Yes, it is. But you mean to say, as a music and art graduate, as 6 years in the arts education that you went through, you don't look at something and say, not in my magazine, this isn't going to be here.
Oh, well, you know what? There's
people... Unless they pay.
Not always the case.
Yeah.
You know, people are emerging with their artwork. They're finding themselves to become or wanting to be an artist at another part of their life, giving themselves a chance in the middle of some other part of their life that they never thought they would. And I see that as a great way of expressing themselves, and I give them the chance, from my point of view, to let them express themselves and open up their world to readers. And like, so I would say, like, well, how did you come across this? Or like, what method do you use? What did you discover? What did you find on your exploration that this is what you wanted to focus in on when you were painting, like landscapes or, like you said, pottery? How did you know that you were going to fall onto this venue in art? And their explanation is a wonderment, because other people are born with those kind of same feelings, only everyone does it a little different. And I give people the opportunity to express themselves and tell us how they did it. And bad art is not really bad. It's just maybe bad taste, or it's not up your alley or whatever. But I don't think there's really anything as bad art, unless it's tasteless or hurts people.
Well, but that's exactly right. There is tasteless art, which is bad art.
I guess you're
the
right
one who defined it. You know, my wonderful wife, who is an artist, and she's always quoting Andy Warhol, who says, art is whatever you can get away with. What do you think about that?
Oh, well, yeah, well, there's an audience for everything.
Is there? I mean, I look at some of the stuff in galleries and other places, and I say, who in the world would put that on their wall?
I am a number one skeptic. I know what you're saying. I know just what you're saying. I often have thought the same thing. But there's another part of me that says, you know, I'm not the only one on this planet, and I shouldn't be judging someone's art, because who am I? This person enjoyed creating this and has a reason for doing it. It lets out a certain kind of energy that this person has to release, and I give him full credit for being able to create it and not just have it linger in their minds. They put out. So there's that other side where it's like, okay, whatever they have created is fine. I just don't want to be a part of it, or it's okay.
But you do say no to people, don't you?
I say no to people. I say yes to people if their artwork talks to me. Their artwork has to talk to me.
Are you online?
Yes.
And what is that address?
It's on issue.com.
Issue?
Issue. It's spelled ISSUU. Issue.com is where you can actually pull up the magazine and read it on your screen, page to page.
Do you think there'll ever be a time when you won't publish? It'll all be online?
No. I love hard copies, because I come from that world.
Do you ever think you want to sell your magazine, make a lot of money?
No. I'll give it to my kids before I do that.
Are your kids artistic?
Yes.
They are?
Yes.
Do they ever argue with you about your vision of art?
Well, I think when I try to drag them to play rehearsal with me, they're kind of like...
Oh, you're an actress too, aren't
yeah.
you? We forgot to talk about that.
Oh,
and you,
love it.
And how did you get into that very quickly?
I read Les Miserables, complete book, and I fell in love with Les Mis. And from that point, I got the video of it, and I was watching the 25th anniversary of Les Mis on the TV, over and over and over again, and I realized that I wanted to be a part of it. So it just so happened that they were doing Oliver. They were putting out the audition notice in the Eagle.
From the Berkshire Theater Group.
Berkshire Theater Group, exactly. So I auditioned.
Kate McGuire, Esquire.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. And I was taking acting classes, and I said, I'm going to go for it, and I got in. And then I...
Who'd you play, the mom?
I was a strawberry picker.
Right.
But being a part of the whole group was amazing. It was amazing. The theater there was incredible. That was my first experience, and it was like incredible passion.
Have you been doing more?
And now with Point of View Players, yes, I'm doing more.
What's the Point of View Players?
Point of View Plays is run by Iris. It's local in Albany.
Yeah.
She has a company, a theater company, and I've been part of it. I started out as a stage manager at one of the temples that she had her first play at that I was part of. And then she's been doing plays since, and I've been in them ever since. And my roles have been developing, and I just finished being in The Odd Couple female version, and I was Florence Unger, which was the lead role. So it's an incredible world.
Well, I have to say to you, Harriet, Harriet, Candy, C-A-N-D-E-E, that this has been a wonderful hour. I'm so pleased.
Thank you so much
for coming over. I've had such a good time, and we appreciate it so much.
Wow, an hour went by already?
Hour's gone.
Oh, thank you so much.
We've been talking with Harriet Candy, creator of Artful Mind magazine and freelance artist currently teaching art at the Renaissance Art School in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Harriet, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.